Kawahara raised her eyes theatrically to the ceiling. "I framed Elias Riker. I set him up with a false tip about a clinic in Seattle. We built a phone construct of Riker and used it to pay Ignacio Garcia to fake the reasons of conscience decals on two of Riker's kills. We knew the Seattle PD wouldn't buy it, and that Garcia's faking wouldn't stand up to close scrutiny. There. Is that better?"
"Where'd you get Garcia from?"
"Research on Riker, back when we were trying to buy him off."
Kawahara shifted impatiently on the lounger.
"The connection came up."
"Yeah, that's what I figured."
"How perceptive of you."
So everything was nicely nailed down, until Resolution 653 came along and stirred it all up again, and Hinchley was still a live case. Kawahara inclined her head.
"Just so."
"Why didn't you just stall it? Buy some decision-makers on the UN Council?"
"Who? This isn't New Beijing. You met Fury and Ertekin. Do they look as if they're for sale?"
I nodded. "So it was you in Marco's sleeve. Did Miriam Bancroft know?"
"Miriam?"
Kawahara looked perplexed.
"Of course not. No one knew. That was the point. Marco plays Miriam on a regular basis. It was a perfect cover."
"Not perfect. You play shit tennis, apparently."
"I didn't have time for a competence disc."
"Why Marco? Why not just go as yourself?" Kawahara waved a hand.
"I'd been hammering at Bancroft since the resolution was tabled. Ertekin, too, whenever she let me near her. I was making myself conspicuous. Marco putting in a word on my behalf makes me look more detached."
"You took that call from Rutherford," I said, mostly to myself. "The one to Suntouch House after we dropped in on him. I figured it was Miriam, but you were there as a guest, playing Marco on the sidelines of the great Catholic debate."
"Yes."
A faint smile.
"You seem to have greatly overestimated Miriam Bancroft's role in all this. Oh, by the way, who is that you've got wearing Riker's sleeve at the moment? Just to satisfy my curiosity. He's very convincing, whoever he is."
I said nothing, but a smile leaked from one corner of my mouth. Kawahara caught it.
"Really? Double sleeving? You really must have Lieutenant Ortega wrapped around your little finger. Or wrapped around something, anyway. Congratulations. Manipulation worthy of a meth."
She barked a short laugh.
"That was meant as a compliment, Takashi-san."
I ignored the jab. "You talked to Bancroft in Osaka? Thursday, the 16th of August, you knew he was going?"
"Yes. He has regular business there. It was made to look like a chance encounter. I invited him to head in the clouds on his return. It's a pattern for him, buying sex after business deals. You probably found that out."
"Yeah. So when you got him up here, what did you tell him?"
"I told him the truth."
"The truth?" I stared at her. "You told him about Hinchley and expected him to back you?"
"Why not?"
There was a chilling simplicity in the look she gave me back.
"We have a friendship that goes back centuries. Common business strategies that have sometimes taken longer than a normal human lifetime to bring to fruition. I hardly expected him to side with the little people."
"So he disappointed you. He wouldn't keep the meth faith." Kawahara sighed again. And this time there was a genuine weariness in it that gusted out of somewhere centuries deep in dust.
"Lorenz maintains a cheap romantic streak that I continually underestimate. He is not unlike you in many ways, but unlike you, he has no excuse for it. The man is over 3 centuries old. I assumed, wanted to assume perhaps, that his values would reflect that the rest was just posturing. Speech-making for the herd."
Kawahara made a negligent what-can-you-do gesture with one slim arm.
"Wishful thinking, I'm afraid."
"What did he do? Take some kind of moral stand?" Kawahara's mouth twisted without humor.
You mock me? You with the blood of dozens from the Y Clinic fresh on your hands? A butcher for the Protectorate, an extinguisher of human life on every world where it has managed to find a foothold. You are, if I may say so, Takashi, a little inconsistent.
Secure in the cool wrap of the betathenatine, I could feel nothing beyond a mild irritation at Kawahara's obtuseness, a need to clarify. The Y Clinic was personal.
The Y Clinic was business, Takashi. They had no personal interest in you at all. Most of the people you wiped were merely doing their jobs.
Then they should have chosen another job.
And the people of Sharya, what choice should they have made? Not to be born in that particular world at that particular time? Not to allow themselves to be conscripted, perhaps?
I was young and stupid, I said simply. I was used. I killed for people like you because I knew no better. Then I learned better. What happened at Inanin taught me better. Now I don't kill for anyone but myself, and every time that I take a life, I know the value of it.
The value of it. The value of a human life.
Kawahara shook her head like a teacher with an exasperating student.
You are still young and stupid. Human life has no value. Haven't you learned that yet, Takashi, with all you've seen? It has no value intrinsic to itself. Machines cost money to build. Raw materials cost money to extract, but people...
She made a tiny spitting sound.
You can always get some more people. They reproduce like cancer cells, whether you want them or not. They are abundant, Takashi. Why should they be valuable? Do you know that it costs us less to recruit and use up a real snuff whore than it does to set up and run the virtual equivalent format? Real human flesh is cheaper than a machine. It's the axiomatic truth of our times.
Bancroft didn't think so.
Bancroft?
Kawahara made a disgusted noise deep in her throat.
Bancroft is a cripple, limping along on his archaic notions. It's a mystery to me how he survived this long.
So you programmed him to suicide? Gave him a little chemical push?
Programmed him to...
Kawahara's eyes widened, and a delighted chuckle that was just the right blend of husk and chime issued from her sculpted lips.
Kovach, you can't be that stupid. I told you he killed himself. It was his idea, not mine. There was a time when you trusted my word, even if you couldn't stomach my company. Think about it. Why would I want him dead?
To erase what you told him about Henchley. When he was resleeved, his last update would be minus that little indiscretion. Kawahara nodded sagely.
Yes, I can see how that would fit for you. A defensive move. You have, after all, existed on the defensive since you left the envoys. And a creature that lives on the defensive sooner or later comes to think on the defensive. You are forgetting one thing, Takashi.
She paused dramatically, and even through the betathenatine, a vague ripple of mistrust tugged at me. Kawahara was overplaying it. And what's that?
That I, Takashi Kovach, am not you. I do not play on the defensive.
Not even at tennis? She offered me a calibrated little smile.
Very witty. I did not need to erase Lorenz Bancroft's memory of our conversation, because by then he had slaughtered his own Catholic whore and had as much to lose as I from Resolution 653.
I blinked. I'd had a variety of theories circling around the central conviction that Kawahara was responsible for Bancroft's death, but none quite this garish. But as Kawahara's words sunk in, so did a number of pieces from that jagged mirror that I thought was already complete enough to see the truth in. I looked into that newly revealed corner and wished I had not seen the things that moved there. Opposite me, Kawahara grinned at my silence. She knew she'd dented me, and it pleased her. Vanity, vanity. Kawahara's only but enduring flaw. Like all myths, she had grown very impressed with herself. The admission, the final piece to my jigsaw, had slipped out easily. She wanted me to have it, She wanted me to see how far ahead of me she was, how far behind her I was limping along. That crack about the tennis must have touched a nerve.
"Another subtle echo of his wife's face," she said, "carefully selected and then amped up with a little cosmetic surgery. He choked the life out of her. As he was coming for the second time, I think. Married life, eh, Kovach? What it must do to you males."
"You got it on tape?" My voice sounded stupid in my own ears. Kawahara's smile came back.
"Come on, Kovach. Ask me something that needs an answer."
"Bancroft was chemically assisted?"
"Oh, but of course. You were right about that. Quite a nasty drug, but then I expect you know..."
It was the betathenatine, the heart-dragging slow chill of the drug, because without it, I would have been moving with a breath of air as the door opened on my flank. The thought crossed my mind as rapidly as it was able, and even as it did, I knew by its very presence that I was going to be too slow. This was no time for thinking. Thought in combat was a luxury about as appropriate as a hot bath and massage. It fogged the whiplash clarity of the Kamala's Norikem response system, and I spun, just a couple of centuries too late, shard gun lifting.
Splat!
The stun bolt slammed through me like a train, and I seemed to see the brightly lit carriage windows ratcheting past behind my eyes. My vision was a frozen frame on Trep, crouched in the doorway, stun gun extended, face watchful in case she'd missed or I was wearing neural armor beneath the stealth suit. Some hope. My own weapon dropped from nerveless fingers as my hands spasmed open and I pitched forward beside it. The wooden floor came up and smashed me on the side of the head like one of my father's cuffs.
"What kept you?"
Kawahara's voice asked from a great height, distorted to a bass growl by my fading consciousness. One slim hand reached into my field of vision and retrieved the shard gun. Numbly, I felt her other hand tug the stun gun free of the other holster.
"Alarm only went off a couple of minutes ago."
Trep stepped into view, stowing her stun gun, and crouched to look at me curiously.
"Took McCabe a while to cool off enough to trip the system. Most of your half-assed security is still up on the main deck, goggling at the corpse. Who's this?"
"It's Kovach," Kawahara said dismissively, tucking the shard gun and stunner into her belt on her way to the desk. To my paralyzed gaze, she appeared to be retreating across a vast plain, hundreds of meters with every stride until she was tiny and distant. Doll-like, she leaned on the desk and punched at controls I could not see. I wasn't going under.
"Kovach?"
Trep's face went abruptly impassive.
"I thought..." "Yes, so did I."
The holographic data weave above the desk awoke and unwound. Kawahara put her face closer, colors swirling over her features.
"He double-sleeved on us, presumably with Ortega's help. You should have stuck around the Panama Rose a little longer."
My hearing was still mangled, my vision frozen in place, but I wasn't going under. I wasn't sure if it was some side effect of the betathenatine, another bonus feature of the Kamala system, or maybe both in some unintended conjunction, but something was keeping me conscious.
"Being around a crime scene with that many cops makes me nervous,"
Trep said, and put out a hand to touch my face.
"Yeah?"
Kawahara was still absorbed in the data flow.
"Well, distracting this psycho with moral debate and true confessions hasn't been good for my digestion, either. I thought you were never going to..." "Fuck!"
She jerked her head savagely to one side, then lowered it, and stared at the surface of the desk.
"He was telling the truth."
"About what?"
Kawahara looked up at Trep, suddenly guarded.
"Doesn't matter. What are you doing to his face?"
"He's cold."
"Of course he's fucking cold."
The deteriorating language was a sure sign that Raylene Kawahara was rattled, I thought dreamily.
"How do you think he got in past the infrareds? He's stiff to the eyes."
Trep got up, face carefully expressionless.
"What are you going to do with him?"
"He's going into virtual,"
Kawahara said grimly.
along with his Harlanite fishwife friend. But before we do that, we have to perform a little surgery. He's wearing a wire.
I tried to move my right hand. The last joint of the middle finger twitched, barely.
You sure he isn't transmitting?
Yeah, he told me. Anyway, we would have nailed the transmission soon as it started. Have you got a knife?
A bone-deep tremor that felt suspiciously like panic ran through me. Desperately, I reached down into the paralysis for some sign of impending recovery. The Kamala nervous system was still reeling. I could feel my eyes drying out from the lack of a blink reflex. Through smearing vision, I watched Kawahara coming back from the desk, hand held out expectantly to Trep.
I don't have a knife.
I couldn't be certain with a wow and flutter of my hearing, but Trep's voice sounded rebellious.
No problem.
Kawahara took more long strides and disappeared from view, voice fading.
I've got something back here that'll do just as well. You'd better whistle up some muscle to drag this piece of shit up to one of the decanting salons. I think 7 and 9 are prepped. Use the jack on the desk.
Trep hesitated. I felt something drop, like a tiny piece of ice thawing from the frozen block of my central nervous system. My eyelids scraped slowly down over my eyes. Once, and up again. The cleansing contact brought tears. Trep saw it, and stiffened. She made no move toward the desk. The fingers of my right hand twitched and curled. I felt the beginnings of tension in the muscles of my stomach. My eyes moved. Kawahara's voice came through faintly. She must be in the other room beyond the arch.
They coming?
Trep's face stayed impassive. Her eyes lifted from me.
Yeah,
she said loudly.
Be here in a couple of minutes.
I was coming back. Something was forcing my nerves back into sparkling, fizzing life. I could feel the shake setting in, and with it a soupy, suffocating quality to the air in my lungs that meant the betathanatine crash was coming on ahead of schedule. My limbs were molded in lead, and my hands felt as if I was wearing thick cotton gloves with a low electric current fizzing through them. I was in no condition for a fight. My left hand was folded under me, flattened to the floor by the weight of my body. My right trailed out at an awkward side angle. It didn't feel as if my legs would do much more than hold me up. My options were limited.
Right, then.
I felt Kawahara's hand on my shoulder, pulling me onto my back like a fish for gutting. Her face was masked in concentration, and there was a pair of needle-nosed pliers in her other hand. She knelt astride my chest and spread the lids of my left eye with her fingers. I forced down the urge to blink, held myself immobile. The pliers came down, jaws poised a half centimeter apart. I tensed the muscles in my forearm, and the neural spring harness delivered the Tebbit knife into my hand. I slashed sideways. I was aiming for Kawahara's side, below the floating ribs, but the combination of stun shakes and betathanatine crash threw me off, and the knife blade sliced into her left arm below the elbow, jarred on the bone, and bounced off. Kawahara yelled and released her grip on my eye. The pliers plunged down, off course, hit my cheekbone, and carved a trough in the flesh of my cheek. I felt the pain distantly, metal snagging tissue. Blood spilled down into my eye. I stabbed again, weakly, but this time Kawahara twisted astride me and blocked downward with her injured arm. She yelled again, and my fizzing glove grip on the knife slipped. The haft trickled away past my palm, and the weapon was gone. Summoning all my remaining energy into my left arm, I hooked a savage punch up from the floor and caught Kawahara on the temple. She rolled off me, clutching at the wound in her arm, and for a moment I thought the blade had gone deep enough to mark her with a C-381 coating. But Sheila Sorensen had told me that the cyanide poisoning would do its work in the time it takes to draw a couple of breaths. Kawahara was getting up.
"What the fuck are you waiting for?"
she inquired acidly of Trep.
"Shoot this piece of shit, will you?"
Her voice died on the last word, as she saw the truth in Trep's face an instant before the pale woman went for her holstered stun gun. Maybe it was a truth that was only dawning on Trepp herself at that moment, because she was slow. Kawahara dropped the pliers, cleared both shard gun and stunner from her belt with a snap, and leveled them before Trepp's weapon was even halfway out of the holster.
"You traitorous fucking cunt!"
Kawahara spat out wonderingly. Her voice suddenly streaked through with a coarse accent I had never heard before.
"You knew he was coming around, didn't you? You're fucking dead, bitch!"
I staggered upright and lurched into Kawahara just as she pulled the triggers. I heard both weapons discharge, the almost supra-aural whine of the shard gun and the sharp electrical splatter of the stunner. Through the fogged vision in the corner of one eye, I saw Trepp made a desperate bid to complete her draw and not even come close. She went down, face almost comically surprised. At the same time, my shoulder smashed into Kawahara, and we stumbled back toward the slope of the windows. She tried to shoot me, but I flailed the guns aside with my arms and tripped her. She hooked at me with her injured arm, and we both went down on the angled glass. The stunner was gone, skittering across the floor, but she'd managed to hang on to the shard gun. It swung around at me, and I batted it down clumsily. My other hand punched at Kawahara's head, missed, and bounced off her shoulder. She grinned fiercely and head-butted me in the face. My nose broke with a sensation like biting into celery, and blood flooded down over my mouth. From somewhere I suffered an insane desire to taste it. Then Kawahara was on me, twisting me back against the glass and punching solidly into my body. I blocked one or two of the punches, but the strength was puddling out of me, and the muscles in my arms were losing interest. Things started to go numb inside. Above me, Kawahara's face registered a savage triumph as she saw that the fight was over. She hit me once more, with great care, in the groin. I convulsed and slid down the glass into a sprawled heap on the floor.
"That ought to hold you, sport," she grated, and jerked herself back to her feet, breathing heavily.
Beneath the barely disarrayed elegance of her hair, I suddenly saw the face that this new accent belonged to. The brutal satisfaction in that face was what her victims in Fission City must have seen as she made them drink from the dull gray flask of the water carrier.
"You just lie there for a moment."
My body told me that I didn't have any other option. I felt drenched in damage, sinking fast under the weight of the chemicals silting up my system and the shivering neural invasion of the stun bolt. I tried to lift one arm, and it flopped back down like a fish with a kilo of lead in its guts. Kawahara saw it happen and grinned.
"Yeah, that'll do nicely," she said, and looked absently down at her own left arm, where blood was trickling from the rent in her blouse. "You're going to fucking pay for that, Kovach."
She walked across to Trepp's motionless form.
"And you, you fuck," she said,
kicking the pale woman hard in the ribs. The body did not move.
"What did this motherfucker do for you anyway? Promise to eat your cunt for the next decade?"
Trepp made no response. I strained the fingers of my left hand and managed to move my hand almost its own width across the floor toward my leg. Kawahara went to the desk with a final backward glance at Trepp's body and touched a control.
"Security?"
"Ms. Kawahara?"
It was the same male voice that had grilled Ortega on our approach to the airship.
"There's been an incursion on the..."
"I know what there's been,"
Kawahara said tiredly.
"I've been wrestling with it for the last 5 minutes. Why aren't you down here?"
"Ms. Kawahara?"
"I said, how long does it take you to get your synthetic ass down here on a call-out?"
There was a brief silence. Kawahara waited, head bowed over her desk. I reached across my body and my right and left hands met in a weak clasp, then curled closed on what they held and fell back.
"Ms. Kawahara, there was no alert from your cabin."
"Oh."
Kawahara turned back to look at Trepp.
"Okay. We'll get someone down here now, squad of four. There's some garbage to take out."
"Yes, ma'am."
In spite of everything, I felt a smile crawl under my mouth. "Ma'am?" Kawahara came back, scooping the pliers up off the floor on her way.
"What are you grinning at, Kovach?"
I tried to spit at her, but the saliva barely made it out of my mouth and hung in a thick streamer over my jaw, mingled with the blood. Kawahara's face distorted with sudden rage, and she kicked me in the stomach. On top of everything else, I barely felt it.
"You!"
she began savagely, then forced the level of her voice back down to an accentless, icy calm.
"Have caused more than enough trouble for one lifetime."
She took hold of my collar and dragged me up the angled slope of the window until we were at eye level. My head lolled back on the glass, and she leaned over me. Her tone eased back, almost to conversational.
"Like the Catholics, like your friends at Inanin, like the pointless motes of slum life whose pathetic copulations brought you into existence, Takashi. Human raw material, that's all you've ever been. You could have evolved beyond it and joined me on New Beijing, but you spat in my face and went back to your little people existence. You could have joined us again here on Earth, joined in the steerage of the whole human race this time. You could have been a man of power, Kovach. Do you understand that? You could have been significant."
"I don't think so," I murmured weakly, starting to slide back down the glass. "I've still got a conscience rattling around in here somewhere. Just forgotten where I put it." Kawahara grimaced and redoubled her hold on my collar.
"Very witty. Spirited. You're going to need that where you're going."
"When they ask how I died," I said, "tell them, still angry."
"Quell."
Kawahara leaned closer. She was almost lying on top of me now, like a sated lover.
"But Quell never went into virtual interrogation, did she? You aren't going to die angry, Kovach. You're going to die pleading, over and over again."
She shifted her hold to my chest and pressed me down hard. The pliers came up.
"Have an aperitif."
The jaws of the tool plunged into the underside of my eye, and a spurt of blood sprinkled Kawahara's face. Pain flared brightly. For a moment, I could see the pliers through the eye they were embedded in, towering away like a massive steel pylon, and then Kawahara twisted the jaws and something burst. My vision splashed red and then winked out, a dying monitor screen like the ones at Elliot's data linkage. From my other eye, I saw Kawahara withdraw the pliers with Reese's recording wire gripped in the jaws. The rear end of the tiny device dripped minute spots of gore onto my cheek. She'd go after Elliot and Reese, not to mention Ortega, Bautista, and who knew how many others.
"That's fucking enough," I muttered in a slurred tone.
And at the same moment, driving the muscles in my thighs to work, I locked my legs around Kawahara's waist. My left hand slapped down flat on the sloping glass. The muffled crump of an explosion and a sharp cracking. Dialed to the short end of its fuse option, the termite microgrenade was designed to detonate almost instantaneously and to deliver 90% of its charge to the contact face. The remaining 10% still wrecked my hand, tearing the flesh from the Kumalo marrow alloy bones and carbon-reinforced tendons, ripping the polybond ligamenting apart, and punching a coin-sized hole in my palm. On the downward side, the window shattered like a thick plate of river ice. It seemed to happen in slow motion. I felt the surface cave in beside me, and then I was sliding sideways into the gap. Vaguely, I registered the rush of cold air into the cabin. Above me, Kawahara's face had gone stupid with shock as she realized what had happened, but she was too late. She came with me, flailing and smashing at my head and chest, but unable to break the lock I had on her waist. The pliers rose and fell, peeling a long strip of flesh from one cheekbone, plunging once into my wrecked eye. But by now the pain was far away, almost irrelevant, consumed entire by a bonfire of rage that had finally broken through what was left of the beta-thanatine. Tell them, still angry. Then, the portion of glass we were struggling on gave way and tipped us out into the wind and sky. And we fell. My left arm was paralyzed in position by some damage the explosion had done, but as we started to tumble down through the chill darkness, I brought my right hand around and cupped the other grenade against the base of Kawahara's skull. I had a confused glimpse of the ocean far below, head in the clouds rocketing upward away from us, and an expression on Raylene Kawahara's face that had left sanity as far behind as the airship. Something was screaming, but I no longer knew if the sound came from within or without. Perception was spiraling away from me in the shrill whistling of the air around us, and I could no longer find my way back to the little window of individual viewpoint. The fall was as seductive as sleep. With what remained of my will, I clamped grenade and skull against my own chest, hard enough to detonate. My last thought was the hope that Davidson was watching his screen. Chapter 42. The address was, ironically enough, down in Licktown. I left the auto cab 2 blocks north and walked the rest of the way, unable to quite shake an eerie feeling of synthesis, as if the machinery of the cosmos were suddenly poking through the fabric of reality for me to see. The apartment I was looking for formed part of a U-shaped block with a cracked and weed-grown concrete landing area in the center. Amongst the array of sad-looking ground and flight vehicles, I spotted the microcopter immediately. Someone had given it a purple and red trim paint job recently, and though it still listed wearily to one side on its pods, there were shiny clusters of expensive-looking sensor equipment fitted to the nose and tail. I nodded to myself and went up a flight of external steps to the second floor of the block. The door to number 17 was opened by an 11-year-old boy, who stared at me with blank hostility.
"Yeah?"
"I'd like to speak to Cheryl Bostock."
"Yeah? Well, she ain't here."
I sighed and rubbed the scar under my eye. "I think that's probably not true. Her copter's in the yard. You're her son Darryl, and she came off night shift about 3 hours ago. Will you tell her there's someone to see her about the Bancroft sleeve?"
"You the Shia?"
"No, I just want to talk. If she can help me, there might be some money in it for her." The boy stared at me for another pair of seconds, then closed the door without a word. From inside, I heard him calling his mother. I waited and fought the urge to smoke. 5 minutes later, Cheryl Bostock appeared around the edge of the door, dressed in a loose caftan. Her synthetic sleeve was even more expressionless than her son had been, but it was a slack-muscled blankness that had nothing to do with attitude. Small muscle groups take a while to warm up from sleep on the cheaper model synthetics, and this was definitely a model from the cut-price end of the market.
"You want to see me?"
the synth voice asked unevenly.
"What for?"
"I'm a private investigator working for Lorenz Bancroft," I said as gently as I could. "I'd like to ask you a few questions about your duties at Psychosec. May I come in?" She made a small noise, one that made me think she'd probably tried to shut doors in men's faces before without success. "It won't take long." She shrugged and opened the door wide. I passed her and stepped into a tidily kept but threadbare room, whose most important feature was clearly a sleek black entertainment deck. The system reared off the carpeting in the far corner like an obscure machine god's idol, and the remaining furniture had been rearranged around it in obeisance. Like the microcopter's paint job, it looked new. Darryl had disappeared from view. "Nice deck," I said, going over to examine the machine's raked display front. "When did you get it?"
"A while ago."
Cheryl Bostock closed the door and came to stand uncertainly in the center of the room. Her face was waking up, and now its expression hovered midway between sleep and suspicion.
"What do you want to ask me?"
"May I sit down?" She motioned me wordlessly to one of the brutally used armchairs and seated herself opposite me in a lounger. In the gaps left by the caftan, her synthetic flesh looked pinkish and unreal. I looked at her for a while, wondering if I wanted to go through with this after all.
Well?
She jerked her hand at me nervously.
What did you want to ask me? You wake me up after the night shift. You'd better have a good goddamn reason for this.
On Tuesday, the 14th of August, you went into the Bancroft family's sleeping chamber and injected a Lorenz Bancroft clone with a full hyperspray of something. I'd like to know what it was, Cheryl. The result was more dramatic than I would have imagined possible. Cheryl Bostock's artificial features flinched violently, and she recoiled as if I'd threatened her with a riot prod.
That's part of my usual duties,
she cried shrilly.
I'm authorized to perform chemical input on the clones.
It didn't sound like her speaking. It sounded like something someone had told her to memorize. Was it cinnamorphesterone? I asked quietly. Cheap synths don't blush or go pale, but the look on her face conveyed the message just as effectively. She looked like a frightened animal, betrayed by its owner.
How do you know that? Who told you that?
Her voice scaled to a high sobbing.
You can't know that. She said no one would know.
She collapsed onto the sofa, weeping into her hands. Darryl emerged from another room at the sound of his mother crying, hesitated in the doorway, and evidently deciding that he couldn't or shouldn't do anything, stayed there watching me with a frightened expression on his face. I compressed a sigh and nodded at him, trying to look as unthreatening as possible. He went cautiously to the sofa and put a hand on his mother's shoulder, making her start as if from a blow. Ripples of memory stirred in me, and I could feel my own expression turning cold and grim. I tried to smile across the room at them, but it was farcical. I cleared my throat. I'm not here to do anything to you, I said. I just want to know. It took a minute or so for the words to get through the cobwebby veils of terror and sink into Cheryl Bostock's consciousness. It took even longer for her to get her tears under control and look up at me. Beside her, Darryl stroked her head doubtfully. I gritted my teeth and tried to stop the memories of my own 11th year welling up in my head. I waited.
It was her,
she said finally. Curtis intercepted me as I came around the seaward wing of Suntouch House. His face was darkened with anger, and his hands were curled into fists at his sides.
She doesn't want to talk to you,
he snarled at me. Get out of my way, Curtis, I said evenly, or you're going to get hurt. His arms snapped up into a karate guard.
I said she does...
At that point I kicked him in the knee, and he collapsed at my feet. A second kick rolled him a couple of meters down the slope toward the tennis courts. By the time he came out of the roll, I was on him. I jammed a knee into the small of his back and pulled his head up by the hair.
I'm not having a great day, I told him patiently, and you're making it worse. Now, I'm going up there to talk to your boss. It'll take about 10 minutes, and then I'll be gone. If you're wise, you'll stay out of the way.
You fuck!
I pulled his hair harder, and he yelped. If you come in there after me, Curtis, I'm going to hurt you. Badly. Do you understand? I'm not in the mood for swamp-suck grifters like you today.
Leave him alone, Mr. Kovach. Weren't you ever 19?
I glanced over my shoulder to where Miriam Bancroft stood with her hands in the pockets of a loose, desert-colored ensemble, apparently modeled on Sharyan harem wear. Her long hair was caught up under the swath of the ochre cloth, and her eyes glinted in the sun. I remembered suddenly what Ortega had said about Nakamura. They use her face and body to sell stuff. Now I could see it, the casual poise of a fashion house sleeve demonstrator. I let go of Curtis's hair and stood back while he climbed to his feet. I wasn't this stupid at any age, I said untruthfully. Do you want to tell him to back off instead? Maybe he'll listen to you.
Curtis, go and wait for me in the limousine. I won't be long.
Are you going to let him...
Curtis.
There was a cordial admonishment in her tone, as if there must be some mistake, as if answering back just wasn't on the menu. Curtis's face flushed when he heard it, and he stalked away from us with tears of consternation standing in his eyes. I watched him out of sight, still not convinced I shouldn't have hit him again. Miriam Bancroft must have read the thought on my face.
"I would have thought even your appetite for violence had been sated by now," she said quietly. "Are you still looking for targets?"
"Who says I'm looking for targets?"
"You did."
I looked quickly at her. "I don't remember that."
"How convenient."
"No, you don't understand." I lifted my open hands toward her. "I don't remember it. Everything we did together is gone. I don't have those memories. It's been wiped." She flinched as if I'd struck her.
"But you,"
she said in pieces.
"I thought you look..."
"The same." I looked down at myself, at Riker's sleeve. Well, there wasn't much left of the other sleeve when they fished me out of the sea. This was the only option. And the UN investigators point-blank refused to allow another double-sleeving. Don't blame them, really. It's going to be hard enough to justify the one we did as it is.
"But how did you..."
"Decide?" I smiled without much enthusiasm. "Shall we go inside and talk about this?" I let her lead me back up to the conservatory, where someone had set out a jug and tall-stemmed glasses on the ornamental table beneath the martyrweed stands. The jug was filled with a liquid the color of sunsets. We took seats opposite each other, without exchanging words or glances. She poured herself a glass without offering me one, a tiny casualness that spoke volumes about what had happened between Miriam Bancroft and my other self.
"I'm afraid I don't have much time,"
she said absently.
"As I told you on the phone, Lorenz has asked me to come to New York immediately. I was actually on my way out when you called."
I said nothing, waiting. And when she had finished pouring, I got my own glass. The move felt bone-deep wrong, and my awkwardness must have shown. She started with realization.
"Oh, I..."
"Forget it." I settled back into my seat and sipped at the drink. It had a faint bite beneath the mellowness. "You wanted to know how we decided? We gambled. Paper, scissors, stone. Of course, we talked about it for hours first. They had us in a virtual forum over in New York. Very high ratio. Discretion shielded while we made up our minds. No expense spared for the heroes of the hour." I found an edge of bitterness creeping into my voice, and I had to stop to dump it. I took a longer pull at my drink. "Like I said, we talked. A lot. We thought of a lot of different ways to decide. Some of them were maybe even viable, but in the end we kept coming back to it. Scissors, paper, stone. Best of five. Why not?" I shrugged, but it was not the casual gesture I hoped it would appear. I was still trying to shake off the cold that crept through me whenever I thought about the game, trying to second-guess myself with my own existence at stake. The best of five, and it had gone to two all. My heart was beating like the junk rhythm in Jerry's closed quarters, and I was dizzy with adrenaline. Even facing Kawahara hadn't been this hard. When he lost the last round, stone to my paper, we both stared at our two extended hands for what seemed like a long time. Then he'd got up with a faint smile and cocked his thumb and forefinger at his own head, somewhere midway between a salute and a burlesque of suicide. "Anything I should tell Jimmy when I see him?" I shook my head wordlessly. "Well, have a nice life," he said, and left the sunlit room, closing the door gently behind him. Part of me was still screaming inside that he had somehow thrown the last game. They re-sleeved me the next day. I looked up again. "Now I guess you're wondering why I bothered coming here."
"Yes, I am."
"It concerns Cheryl Bostock," I said.
"Who?"
I sighed. "Miriam, please, don't make this any tougher than it already is. Cheryl Bostock is shit scared you're going to have her torched because of what she knows. I've come here to have you convince me she's wrong, because that's what I promised her." Miriam Bancroft looked at me for a moment, eyes widening, and then convulsively, she threw her drink in my face.
"You arrogant little man," she hissed. "How dare you? How dare you?
I wiped drink out of my eyes and stared at her. I'd expected a reaction, but it wasn't this. I raked surplus cocktail from my hair. Excuse me?
How dare you walk in here, telling me this is difficult for you? Do you have any idea what my husband is going through at this moment?
Well, let's see. I wiped my hands clean on my shirt, frowning. Right now, he's the 5-star guest of a UN special inquiry in New York. What do you reckon? The marital separation's getting to him? Can't be that hard to find a whorehouse in New York. Miriam Bancroft's jaw clenched.
You are cruel, she whispered.
And you're dangerous. I felt a little steam wisping off the surface of my own control. I'm not the one who kicked an unborn child to death in San Diego. I'm not the one who dosed her own husband's clone with cinnamorphesterone while he was away in Osaka, knowing full well what he'd do to the first woman he fucked in that state. Knowing that woman wouldn't be you, of course. It's no wonder Cheryl Bostock's terrified. Just looking at you, I'm wondering whether I'll live past the front gates.
Stop it!
She drew a deep, shuddering breath.
Stop it, please!
I stopped. We both sat in silence, she with her head bowed. Tell me what happened, I said finally. I got most of it from Kawahara. I know why Lorenz torched himself.
Do you?
Her voice was quiet now, but there were still traces of her previous venom in the question.
Tell me, what do you know? That he killed himself to escape blackmail? That's what they're saying in New York, isn't it?
It's a reasonable assumption, Miriam, I said quietly. Kawahara had him in a lock. Vote down Resolution 653 or face exposure as a murderer. Killing himself before the needle cast went through to Psychosec was the only way out of it. If he hadn't been so bloody-minded about the suicide verdict, he might have got away with it.
Yes, if you hadn't come.
I made a gesture that felt unfairly defensive. It wasn't my idea.
And what about guilt?
She said into the quiet.
Did you stop to consider that? Did you stop to think how Lorenz must have felt when he realized what he'd done? When they told him that girl Rentang was a Catholic? A girl who could never have her life back? Even if Resolution 653 did force her back into temporary existence to testify against him? Don't you think when he put the gun against his own throat and pulled the trigger that he was punishing himself for what he'd done? Did you ever consider that maybe he was not trying to get away with it, as you put it?
I thought about Bancroft, turning the idea over in my mind, and it wasn't entirely difficult to say what Miriam Bancroft wanted to hear. It's a possibility, I said. She choked a laugh.
It's more than a possibility, Mr. Kovach. You forget, I was here that night. I watched him from the stairs when he came in. I saw his face. I saw the pain on his face. He paid for what he'd done. He judged and executed himself for it. He paid. He destroyed the man who committed the crime, and now a man who has no memory of that crime, a man who did not commit that crime, is living with the guilt again. Are you satisfied, Mr. Kovach?
The bitter echoes of her voice were leached out of the room by the martyr weed. The silence thickened. Why'd you do it? I asked, when she showed no sign of speaking again. Why did Marla Rentang have to pay for your husband's infidelities? She looked at me as if I had asked her for some major spiritual truth, and shook her head helplessly.
It was the only way I could think of to hurt him, she murmured.
No different from Kawahara in the end, I thought with carefully manufactured savagery. Just another myth, moving the little people around like pieces in a puzzle. Did you know Curtis was working for Kawahara? I asked tonelessly.
I guessed. Afterwards.
She lifted a hand.
But I had no way of proving it. How did you work it out?
Retrospectively. He took me to the Hendrix, recommended it to me. Cadman turned up 5 minutes after I went in, on Kawahara's orders. That's too close for a coincidence.
Yes,
she said distantly.
It fits.
Curtis got the cinema festeron for you? She nodded. Through Kawahara, I imagine. A liberal supply as well. He was dosed to the eyes the night you sent him to see me. Did he suggest spiking the clone before the Osaka trip?
No. That was Kawahara.
Miriam Bancroft cleared her throat.
We had an unusually candid conversation a few days before. Looking back, she must have been engineering the whole thing around Osaka.
Yeah, Raylene's pretty thorough. Was pretty thorough. She would have known there was an even chance Lorenz would refuse to back her, so you bribed Cheryl Bostock with a visit to the island funhouse, just like me. Only instead of getting to play with a glorious Miriam Bancroft body like me, she got to wear it. A handful of cash and the promise she could come back and play again someday. Poor cow. She was in paradise for 36 hours, and now she's like a junkie in withdrawal. Were you ever going to take her back there?
I am a woman of my word.
Yeah? Well, as a favor to me, do it soon.
And the rest? You have evidence? You intend to tell Lorenz about my part in this?
I reached into my pocket and produced a matte black disc. Footage of the injection, I said, holding it up. Composite footage of Cheryl Bostock leaving Psychosec and flying to a meeting with your limousine, which subsequently heads out to sea. Without this, there's nothing to say your husband didn't kill Marla Rentang chemically unassisted, but they're probably going to assume Kawahara dosed him aboard Head in the Clouds. There's no evidence, but it's expedient.
How did you know?
She was looking into a corner of the conservatory, voice small and distant.
How did you get to Bostock?
Intuition, mostly. You saw me looking through the telescope? She nodded and cleared her throat.
I thought you were playing with me. I thought you'd told him.
No. I felt a faint stab of anger. Kawahara was still holding my friend in virtual, and threatening to torture her into insanity. She looked sideways at me, then looked away.
I didn't know that,
she said quietly. Yeah, well, I shrugged. The telescope gave me half of it. Your husband aboard Head in the Clouds just before he killed himself. So then I started thinking about all the unpleasant stuff Kawahara had to play with up there, and I wondered if your husband could have been induced to kill himself. Chemically, or through some kind of virtual program. I've seen it done before.
Yes, I'm sure you have.
She sounded tired now, drifting away.
So why look for it at Psychosec and not Head in the Clouds?
I'm not sure. Intuition, like I said. Maybe because chemical mugging aboard an aerial whorehouse just didn't seem like Kawahara's style. Too headlong, too crude. She's a chess player, not a brawler. Was. Or maybe just because I had no way to get into the Head in the Cloud surveillance stack the way I could with Psychosec, and I wanted to do something immediate. In any case, I told the Hendricks to go in and survey standard medical procedures for the clones, then backtrack for any irregularities. That gave me Cheryl Bostock.
How very astute.
She turned to look at me.
And what now, Mr. Kovach? More justice? More crucifixion of the meths?
I tossed the disc onto the table. I had the Hendricks go in and erase the injection footage from Psychosec's files. Like I said, they'll probably assume your husband was dosed aboard Head in the Clouds, the expedient solution. Oh, and we erased the Hendricks' memory of your visit to my room, too, just in case someone wanted to make something of what you said about buying me off. One way or another, I'd say you owe the Hendricks a couple of big favors. It said a few guests every now and then would do. Shouldn't cost much, relatively speaking. I sort of promised on your behalf. I didn't tell her about Ortega's sight of the bedroom scene, or how long it had taken to talk the policewoman around. I still wasn't sure why she'd agreed myself. Instead, I watched the wonder on Miriam Bancroft's face for the full half minute it took her to reach out and close her hand around the disc. She looked up at me over her clenched fingers as she took it.
Why?
I don't know, I said morosely. Who knows? Maybe you and Lorenz deserve each other. Maybe you deserve to go on loving a faithless, sexual maladjust who can't deal with respect and appetite in the same relationship. Maybe he deserves to go on not knowing whether he murdered Ren Tang unprovoked or not. Maybe you're just like Raylene, both of you. Maybe all you meths deserve is each other. All I know is, the rest of us don't deserve you. I got up to go. Thanks for the drink. I got as far as the door.
Takashi.
And turned back, unwilling to face her.
That isn't it,
she said with certainty.
Maybe you believe all those things, but that isn't it, is it?
I shook my head. No, that isn't it, I agreed.
Then why?
Like I said, I don't know why. I stared at her, wondering if I was glad I couldn't remember or not. My voice softened. But he asked me to do it if I won. It was part of the deal. He didn't tell me why. I left her sitting alone amidst the martyr weed. Epilogue. The tide was out at Ember, leaving a wet expanse of sand that stretched almost to the listing wreck of the Free Trade Enforcer. The rocks that the carrier had gashed herself on were exposed, gathered in shallow water at the bow like a fossilized outpouring of the ship's guts. Seabirds were perched there, screaming shrilly at each other. A thin wind came in across the sand and made minute ripples in the puddles left by our footprints. Up on the promenade, Ancona Salamao's face had been taken down, intensifying the bleak emptiness of the street.
I thought you'd have gone,
Irene Elliott said beside me. It's in the pipe. Harlan's world is dragging out the needle cast authorization. They really don't want me back.
And no one wants you here.
I shrugged. It's not a new situation for me. We walked on in silence for a while. It was a peculiar feeling talking to Irene Elliott in her own body. In the days leading up to the Head in the Clouds gig, I'd become accustomed to looking down to her face. But this big-boned blonde sleeve was almost as tall as me, and there was an aura of gaunt competence about her that had come through only faintly in her mannerisms in the other body.
I've been offered a job, she said at length. Security consulting for mainline DHF. You heard of them?
I shook my head.
Quite high profile on the East Coast. They must have their headhunters on the inquiry board or something. Soon as the UN cleared me, they were knocking on the door. Exploding offer. $5,000 if I signed there and then.
Yeah, standard practice. Congratulations. You moving east, or are they going to wire the job through to you here?
Probably do it here, at least for a while. We've got Elizabeth in a virtual condo down in Bay City, and it's a lot cheaper to wire in locally. The startup cost us most of that $5,000, and we figure it'll be a few years before we can afford to re-sleeve her.
She turned a shy smile toward me.
We spend most of our time there at the moment. That's where Victor went today.
You don't need to make excuses for him, I said gently. I didn't figure he'd want to talk to me anyway. She looked away.
It's, you know, he was always so proud and...
Forget it. Someone walked all over my feelings the way I did over his. I wouldn't feel like talking to them either. I stopped and reached in my pocket. Reminds me, I brought something for you. She looked down at the anonymous gray credit chip in my hand.
What's this?
About 80,000, I said. I figure with that you can afford something custom-grown for Elizabeth. If she chooses quick, you could have her sleeved before the end of the year.
What?
She stared at me with a smile slipping off and on her face like someone who has been told a joke she's not sure she understands.
You're giving us... Why? Why are you doing this?
This time I had an answer. I'd been thinking about it all the way up from Bay City that morning. I took Irene Elliott's hand and pressed the chip into it. Because I want there to be something clean at the end of all this, I said quietly. Something I can feel good about. For a moment, she went on staring at me. Then she closed the small gap between us and flung her arms around me with a cry that sent the nearest gulls wheeling up off the sand in alarm. I felt a trickle of tears smeared onto the side of my face, but she was laughing at the same time. I folded my arms around her in return and held her. And for the moments that the embrace lasted, and a little while after, I felt as clean as the breeze coming in off the sea. "You take what is offered," Virginia Vidara said somewhere, "and that must sometimes be enough." It took them another 11 days to authorize the needle cast returning me to Harlan's world, most of which I spent hanging around the Hendricks, watching the news, and feeling oddly guilty about my impending checkout. There were very few actual facts publicly available about the demise of Raylene Kawahara, so the resulting coverage was lurid, sensational, and largely inaccurate. The UN special inquiry remained veiled in secrecy, and when the rumors about the forthcoming adoption of Resolution 653 finally broke, there was little to connect them to what had gone before. Bancroft's name never appeared, nor did mine. I never spoke to Bancroft again. The needle cast authorization and resleeving bond for Harlan's world were delivered to me by Amal Prescott, who, though she was pleasant enough and assured me that the terms of my contract would be honored to the letter, also conveyed a smoothly menacing message that I was not to attempt any further communication with any member of the Bancroft family ever again. The reason cited by Prescott was my deceit over the Jacket Up story, the breach of my much-vaunted word, but I knew better. I'd seen it in Bancroft's face across the inquiry chamber when the facts about Miriam's whereabouts and activities during the assault on Head in the Clouds came out. Despite all his urbane meth bullshit, the old bastard was stabbed through with jealousy. I wondered what he would have done if he'd had to sit through the deleted Hendricks bedroom files. Ortega rode with me to Bay City Central the day of the needle cast, the same day that Mary Lou Hinchley was downloaded into a witness stand synthetic for the opening hearing on Head in the Clouds. There were chanting crowds on the steps up to the entrance hall, faced off against a line of grim-looking, black-uniformed UN public order police. The same crude holographic placards that I remembered from my arrival on Earth bobbed about over our heads as we forced our way through the press. The sky above was an ominous gray. "Fucking clowns," Ortega growled, elbowing the last of the demonstrators out of her way. "If they provoke the pubs, they'll be sorry. I've seen these boys in action before, and it isn't pretty." I ducked around a shaven-headed young man who was punching violently at the sky with one fist and holding one of the placard generators with the other. His voice was hoarse, and he appeared to be working himself into a frenzied trance. I joined Ortega at the upper fringe of the crowd, a little out of breath. "There isn't enough organization here to be a real threat," I said, raising my voice to compete with the crowd. "They're just making a noise." "Yeah, well, that never stopped the pubs before. They're likely to break a few skulls just on general principles. What a fucking mess." "Price of progress, Kristen. You wanted Resolution 653.
I gestured at the sea of angry faces below.
"Now you've got it."
One of the masked and padded men above us broke ranks and came down the steps, riot prod fractionally lifted at his side. His jacket bore a sergeant's crimson slash at the shoulder. Ortega flipped her badge at him, and after a brief, shouted conversation, we were allowed up. The line parted for us, and then the double doors into the hall beyond. It was hard to tell which was the most smoothly mechanical, the doors or the black-clad, faceless figures that stood guard over them. Inside, it was quiet and gloomy, with the stormlight coming through the roof panels. I looked around at the deserted benches and sighed. Whatever world it is, whatever you've done there for better or worse, you always leave the same way. Alone.
"You need a minute?"
I shook my head. "Need a lifetime, Kristen. Maybe then some."
"Stay out of trouble. Maybe you'll get it."
There was an attempt at humor floating in her voice, rather like a corpse in a swimming pool, and she must have realized how it sounded, because the sentence was bitten off. An awkwardness was growing between us, something that had started as soon as they resleeved me in Riker's body for the real-time committee hearings. During the inquiry, we'd been kept too busy to see much of each other, and when the proceedings finally closed and we all went home, the pattern had endured. There'd been a few gutsy, if only superficially satisfying, couplings, but even these had stopped once it became clear that Riker would be cleared and released. Whatever shared warmth we'd been gathered to was out of control now, unsafe, like the flames from a smashed storm lantern, and trying to hold on to it was only getting us both painfully scorched. I turned and gave her a faint smile.
Stay out of trouble, huh? That what you told Trep?
It was an unkind blow, and I knew it. Against all the odds, it seemed Kawahara had missed Trep with everything but the edge of the stun beam. The shard gun, I remembered when they told me, had been dialed down to minimum dispersal just before I went in to face Kawahara. Sheer luck I'd left it that way. By the time the rapidly summoned UN forensics team arrived on Head in the Clouds to take evidence under Ortega's direction, Trep had vanished, as had my grav harness from the atmosphere sampling turret where I'd come aboard. I didn't know whether Ortega and Bautista had seen fit to let the mercenary go in view of the testimony she could give concerning the Panama Rose, or if Trep had simply staggered off stage before the police got there. Ortega had volunteered no information, and there wasn't enough left of our previous intimacy for me to ask her outright. This was the first time we'd discussed it openly. Ortega scowled at me.
You asking me to equate the two of you?
Not asking you to do anything, Kristen, I shrugged. But for what it's worth, I don't see a lot of ground between her and me.
Go on thinking like that. Nothing will ever change for you.
Kristen, nothing ever does change. I jerked a thumb back at the crowd outside. You'll always have morons like that, swallowing belief patterns whole so they don't have to think for themselves. You'll always have people like Kawahara and the Bancrofts to push their buttons and cash in on the program. People like you to make sure the game runs smoothly and the rules don't get broken too often. And when the Meths want to break the rules themselves, they'll send people like Trap and me to do it. That's the truth, Kristen. It's been the truth since I was born 150 years ago. And from what I read in the history books, it's never been any different. Better get used to it. She looked at me levelly for a moment, then nodded as if coming to an internal decision.
You always meant to kill Kawahara, didn't you? This confession bullshit was just to get me along for the ride.
It was a question I'd asked myself a lot, and still didn't have a clear answer. I shrugged again. She deserved to die, Kristen. To really die. That's all I know for certain. Over my head, a faint pattering sounded from the roof panels. I tipped my head back and saw transparent explosions on the glass. It was starting to rain. Gotta go, I said quietly. Next time you see this face, it won't be me wearing it, so if there's anything you want to say... Ortega's face flinched almost imperceptibly as I said it. I cursed myself for the awkwardness and tried to take her hand. Look, if it makes it any easier, no one knows. Bautista probably suspects we got it together, but no one really knows.
I know,
she said sharply, not giving me her hand.
I remember.
I sighed. Yeah, so do I. It's worth remembering, Kristen, but don't let it fuck up the rest of your life. Go get Riker back and get onto the next screen. That's what counts. Oh, yeah. I reached into my coat and extracted a crumpled cigarette pack. And you can have these back. I don't need them anymore. Nor does he, so don't start him off again. You owe me that much, at least. Just make sure he stays off them. She blinked and kissed me abruptly, somewhere between mouth and cheek. It was an inaccuracy I didn't try to correct either way. I turned away, before I could see if there were going to be any tears, and started for the doors at the far end of the hall. I looked back once as I was mounting the steps. Ortega was still standing there, arms wrapped around herself, watching me leave. In the stormlight, it was too far away to see her face clearly. For a moment, something ached in me. Something so deep-rooted that I knew to tear it out would be to undo the essence of what held me together. The feeling rose and splashed like the rain behind my eyes, swelling as the drumming on the roof panels grew, and the glass ran with water. Then I had it locked down. I turned back to the next step, found a chuckle somewhere in my chest, and coughed it out. The chuckle fired up and became a laugh of sorts. Get to the next screen. The doors were waiting at the top, the needle cast beyond. Still trying to laugh, I went through.
This concludes
Altered Carbon by Richard K. Morgan. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for our growing library of inspiring, unabridged audiobooks by renowned authors. We also welcome you to sample all our titles, listen to author biographies, and take advantage of special offers at tantor.com. Or call toll-free 877-7-T-A-N-T-O-R to request a catalog.